The Pasco County DEC is providing this podcast as a public service in order to let you know more about the issues and ideas which Democrats have identified as being very important for voters, and also to provide a forum for Democratic candidates for office. Our podcasts are open to anyone interested in how Pasco Democrats are dealing with the important issues of the day. You can check out our PascoDems.com website and also on Facebook, Pasco Dems, and the views expressed by the guest and host on our podcast are their own, not the views of the Pasco County Democratic Executive Committee. And today our topic is the death penalty and some of the things coming down the road here in Florida in particular. And our guest is Allison Ferber Miller, who is a public defender or a capital defender throughout the state of Florida. She's got a lot of background in this, so I'm going to pay attention to what she has to say. So welcome, Allison. And in a sense, where are we right now in terms of the death penalty in Florida?
Well, we were kind of trucking along in 2015, just to give you a little history. And the death penalty, a case where death is a possible penalty, a trial really has two separate parts of one trial. The first part of the trial is what we call the guilt-innocence phase, mm-hmm. where the judge determines unanimously if a defendant is guilty of first-degree murder beyond a reasonable doubt. Mm-hmm. Only if someone is convicted of first-degree murder in a case where the state of Florida is seeking the death penalty, do we proceed to the second part of the trial, which is the penalty phase. It's mm-hmm. the only time the jury is asked to weigh in on what the sentence should be. And the only options as far as punishment for first-degree murder in Florida are life in prison without the possibility of parole or the death penalty. Mm-hmm. And so to be clear, Florida eliminated parole in the early 90s. And so both options are death. Death by a steel box, concrete box, and I guess when the good Lord decides it's your time to come home, mm-hmm. or death via lethal injection or the electric chair. Mm-hmm. Florida allows defendants to choose how they wish to be executed. We still have the electric chair, somewhat of an interesting side note. Interesting and a very macabre type side note is that big energy, most energy companies did not want to be associated with providing the power electric chair, and so the Florida Department of Corrections actually maintains its own power grid to spark up old Sparky should we need it. I don't know that anyone has elected the electric chair since we went to the lethal injection.
Yeah,
but Florida is one of 13 active death penalty states. Mm-hmm. More than half the states or territories in this country have either abolished, have a gubernatorial moratorium, or have not executed a defendant in more than 10 years.
Right.
And so Florida is still very actively executing defendants. We just executed Donald Dilbeck on February 23rd. Mr. Dilbeck committed horrible crimes, but had probably for every action, there's an equal and opposite reaction. For mm-hmm. To the extent of the atrocities that Mr. Dilbeck committed, his life was full of sort of an equal level of abuse and trauma. He suffered horrific abuse as a child, and sexual abuse. He was incarcerated as an adult at the age of 15, and he has had what we now know is called fetal alcohol spectrum disorder. And his lawyers have been litigating before we knew that that was even a thing. NDPAE, neurodevelopmental prenatal alcohol exposure, or fetal alcohol spectrum disorder. His lawyers had been litigating that Mr. Dilbeck's brain was damaged because of extensive in utero alcohol exposure mm-hmm. before the legal community had really caught up with the science in Florida on that. And it wasn't recognized to the extent that it is now. And so then when it became a more recognizable syndrome or spectrum disorder, Mr. Dilbeck's lawyers tried to raise that again to defend him. And they were told basically that they were barred from raising it now. And so he was executed, and the jury that sentenced Mr. Dilbeck to die did so with an 8-4 recommendation, which is mm-hmm. relevant to sort of the status of where we're at now. Yeah. So it takes all 12 jurors to convict a man for first-degree murder. It currently, in Florida, takes all 12 jurors to sentence that same man to die. Mm-hmm. And for some reason, the legislature believes that the standard for which a man should be sent, or woman, but a person should be sentenced to die, the legislature believes, and the governor believes, that standard should be less than what is required for conviction, yeah. which I have a hard time appreciating.
Yeah. Now, one of the things I was doing to prepare for talking with you today is I started reading about the death penalty, and two things. Number one, obviously, going way back a long time, the Code of Hammurabi and eye for an eye and all that sort of thing, and part of natural law in there. And then going up to the colonial times where people could be put to death for cutting down a tree or robbing a rabbit warren, or one that I was noting that I was surprised that reading, trading with an Indian could possibly be leaving them in a death penalty. But the other thing, I had taken a course a couple of years ago in one of those online courses in restorative justice. And I'm leaping way ahead now because I'm wondering whether or not, in the case you were just talking about, restorative justice might have been a way out for everybody.
Well, I don't know that anyone pursued that. Restorative justice is not a legally cognizable defense in Florida. Right. And certainly the woman that Mr. Dilbeck killed, her family was present at his execution, and mm-hmm. they wrote a letter in support of it. He had been on death row since the early 90s. And so, you know, it's hard because I don't ever want to presume to be able to tell people who have lost loved ones yeah. through murder how to grieve. Yeah. What I can tell you is I've been doing this for about 15 years, and I was with the Public Defender's Office. I was the capital case coordinator handling all of the death penalty cases in Pinellas and Pasco County for the office. Now I'm in private practice working statewide with the firm Ripley Wisenhunt, but I've seen these things sort of start to end. And what I can tell you is that if the death penalty could make people whole, if it could heal the loss, I would be wildly in support of it. But it can't, right? Especially when we're talking about parents who have lost right. children, right? And so I think when you're in this profound grief, you want to believe that if this person responsible gets justice, and you perceive that justice to be death, if this person is killed, that will somehow make me feel better. And the yeah. reality is, nothing can make you feel better. Right. Your child has been murdered.
Right.
And so if we had, the criminal justice system is not equipped to heal people or make people whole. I actually am good friends with the Gromayers, who are remarkable people. Andy Gromayer spoke in front of the Senate Criminal Justice Committee yesterday, and I'm reminded by what a remarkable human he is in hearing his testimony. They wrote a book based on their experience, but their daughter was murdered by her partner mm-hmm. in Tallahassee. And at the time, the death penalty was contemplated, and they have two other daughters, and it wasn't like they were any less sad about the daughter's yeah. murder, but they knew they had to find a way to continue living for their other children.
Right.
And so they pursued different avenues of justice. They traveled, you know, across the country, really internationally, looking for, I'm not sure what the right word is, something that felt better or more holistic than the yeah. American criminal justice system they were experiencing in Florida. And so they really brought restorative justice to the state attorney's office in Tallahassee. And kind of, you know, amusing anecdote, they sat in a room at some point with this man who had killed their daughter. Mm-hmm. And they forgave him, not for him, but for them.
Yeah.
But they said that the people who were by far the most uncomfortable in this process were, of course, the public defender and the state attorney, because it's so alien right. to our usual justice system.
Mm-hmm.
But I have to tell you is that And the Gromaires are Catholic. I also am Catholic and met them through work with the Florida Conference of Catholic Bishops. And I don't know that I possess the grace that they do, but what I can tell you is that they are whole and well. And again, it doesn't mean they mourn the loss of their daughter any less.
Right.
But they are well and healthy in a way that, quite frankly, most next of kin or loved ones of murder victims who I interact with are just not. And so I'm not suggesting that what they did or they went through is the answer for everyone, but I can tell you that they are a family who pursued restorative justice, which was very much foreign to the Florida criminal justice system, and that they are, you know, as healthy as two people who lost a child to murder can possibly be.
Yeah. It's interesting, too, for me, I've done a lot of research over the years into the Navajo. And I'm probably mispronouncing, but they have a thing called Hasro, which means that when someone, a Navajo, has committed a crime, it is not simply, it's not a matter of throwing them in jail or giving them a death penalty, for example. They believe you have to restore that person to become at one with nature. Now, for a lot of people, that's way beyond anything that would be, you know, permissible and so forth. But from their point of view, it's, why does a person commit the crime? Because they're out of step with things. They're out of tune with nature. But talking about that restorative thing for a moment, one of the things I had a whole list of pros and cons regarding the death penalty, and you were absolutely right. One of the things that was noted was that the death penalty does not really help the people who have suffered a great deal. That's not the answer. And it doesn't restore them to a good sense of I don't know, equality or something like that. Anyway, I'm going off and I apologize.
Anything that can't, right? People constantly pose this question to me, like, I have a 7-year-old daughter. How would I feel if something happened to my child?
Right.
Right. God willing, I never have to experience that. And there is nothing that the criminal justice system can do to ever heal that loss. And so I'm not minimizing. I mean, it is. And sometimes I find myself, I mean, I've tried a lot of cases. I've defended a lot of capital cases, some more horrific than others. And I sometimes find myself sitting in court looking at the next kin or the family thinking, like, if killing my client would bring these people an ounce of relief, should we do it? And the reality is, it's just not capable of healing the kind of loss that we're talking about. And, you know, beyond just not being able to make people whole who have suffered the loss of a family member through murder, the death penalty unequivocally does not serve as a deterrent to violent crime.
Right.
The opposite.
Right.
States with active death penalty states categorically have higher rates of violent crime than states without death penalty. Right. And when you talk about the historical origins, and I know you're a Navajo Nation buff, but most of the historical origins of the modern day death penalty relate to lynching.
Yeah.
It is, really an uncontrovertible fact that you are far more likely to be sentenced to death if you are black and your victim is white.
Yes, yes.
And so the underpinnings of the modern day death penalty that we see in Florida directly relate to lynching.
Right. Let's talk about for a moment about the death penalty and wrongful deaths that have been that have happened in person in terms of people convicted and then found out to be later innocent.
Right. Well, and so, of course, you know, it's like Florida leads the country in all of the wrong ways.
Yes.
So the national average is 1 in 9. The average in Florida is 1 in 3. And I'll explain that. For every 3 people sentenced to die, 1 is exonerated. Mm-hmm. By exonerated, I mean determined to be factually innocent, not just like shouldn't have been sentenced to die.
Right.
Didn't convict. Crime. Mm-hmm. And so think about that 1 in 3. It's almost exact. Now it is exact with Mr. Dilbeck's execution. Mr. Dilbeck was the 100th person Florida had executed in what we call the modern era of the death penalty.
Right.
It was brought in 1976. And Florida has exonerated 30 defendants from death row. There are currently 300 men on Florida's death row, which is a union correctional institution. Right. But that's one of those things where it's like, we get it wrong a lot. And death, yeah, of course, has a finality to it. No takes these backsies. And so if we get it wrong as frequently as we do, is it something we should be doing? And that's, mm-hmm, where I think I really struggle with what the legislature is attempting to do. And so when I said we were trucking along in 2015, the law required all 12 jurors to convict a person of first degree murder, but only a majority was required, 7-5, to sentence a person to die. Mm-hmm. And there was also what was called a judicial override, that even with a life verdict, a judge could unilaterally decide to sentence a person to death. Mm-hmm. And so I thought a lot about this, right? Like, I think we all assume judges have some sort of legal expertise that the rest of us don't.
Oh.
But the decision to kill someone is an individual moral assessment. And, mm-hmm, we certainly gain any kind of morality compass while in law school. But so I say that because the United States Supreme Court in Hearst v. Florida in 2016 said that particular component, the judicial override component, right, was unconstitutional. And so it shut down the entirety of Florida's death penalty system. The Sixth Amendment to the United States Constitution requires a jury to decide that sentence, not a judge, mm-hmm, is what Florida decided. Mm-hmm. And then in response to that, the Florida Supreme Court decided Hearst v. State at the end of 2016 and required unanimity in capital sentencing. And so the legislature, right, the courts interpret the law, the legislature makes the law. And so the legislature changed the laws twice, once in 2016 in response to the SCOTUS case, mm-hmm, and then once in March of 2017 in response to the Florida Supreme Court. So as of March 9th of 2017, Florida began requiring unanimity, all 12 jurors to believe that death was the appropriate penalty for death to be the penalty.
Mm-hmm. Now, and
that's where we were trucking along until,
right,
frankly, until Nicholas Cruz received a life verdict. Mm-hmm. And how the Florida legislature is trying to recede from unanimity to go back to what we are saying, we call it 8-4, that it would order, right, for a death verdict or a death recommendation to be returned, 8 of 12 jurors would have to be in favor of the death penalty, right, instead of a unanimous jury.
So now let's do this. Let's wrap this up today by saying this. What are the pros? What are the cons of DeSantis and what he's trying to do? And what do you think that we as Democrats could do, either as a party or as individuals?
I mean, there are no pros. I mean, the only pro is if you are an ardent proponent of the death penalty, it will make it easier to sentence people to die.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know that it should be easy. And, you know, it's interesting to me because all of the people ask me all the time, well, how many states require unanimity in capital sentencing? And the answer is really all of them, with one exception. Alabama requires 10-2. And at any time we're rivaling Alabama in criminal justice, it's not usually a good thing. Yeah. And even Alabama has a unanimity bill on the books this legislative session there. And Governor Ivey has actually paused executions in Alabama to re-examine their lethal injection protocol.
Right.
And so like Texas, that we all think of as, you know, a hang 'em high, kill 'em state, Texas has required unanimity forever. And you don't hear the Texas Prosecuting Attorneys Association complaining about this unanimity requirement, mm-hmm, right? That just something that is part of the law. And so in going back to an 8-4, one of the things we talk about is it further erodes that reliability protection, right? So it makes it even more likely that innocent people, uh-huh, will be sentenced to die. It's a tragedy alone when innocent people are convicted. But again, there's a real finality with the death penalty once someone's executed that can't be undone. And so eroding, and when we talk about, you mentioned earlier, those exonerations from Florida's death row and how we lead the country in exonerations, almost all of the exonerations from death row, the defendant sentenced to die were sentenced with non-unanimous juries, uh-huh, or were sentenced as a result of a judicial override from a life verdict to death. Mm-hmm. And so big con is more innocent people likely sentenced to die. But beyond that, I think it's very likely the United States Supreme Court will find the legislation that's currently being proposed in both the Florida Senate and Florida House unconstitutional.
Mm-hmm.
The United States Supreme Court decided a case called Ramos v. Louisiana in 2020. In 2020, why that's relevant is the partisan makeup of the Supreme Court was the same as it is now. The only addition is Justice Ketanji Brown Jackson. She is perceived to be a liberal justice who replaced a liberal justice. But otherwise, right, our conservative brethren were on the court at that point. And in Ramos, the Supreme Court said that unanimity required for conviction. But the same logic that the court applied, and it's an opinion authored by Justice Gorsuch, who again is perceived as very conservative, the same logic that exists in that case will likely apply to unanimity in capital sentencing. And prosecutors with integrity, I have heard pretty much say the same. Gail Levine is a prosecutor, former prosecutor from Miami, and she was one of the toughest, most aggressive in pursuing the death penalty. And she participated in a panel in Parkland after the Cruz verdict. And she sat on a panel with Maria DeLiberato, the executive director of Floridians for Alternatives to the Death Penalty, with Tony Montalto, whose daughter was murdered at Marjorie Stoneman Douglas, a couple members of the Florida legislature. And Gail said, if we're really being honest with ourselves, Ramos is going to control here, and the Supreme Court is going to, I'm paraphrasing, of course, is going to find these laws that have been proposed unconstitutional, and we're going to be forced, much like we were after Hearst was decided, to retry all of these cases. And so we are still retrying cases from when Hearst was decided in 2017. I have a case from 1996. I'm retrying. I have a case from 1974. I'm retrying. Mine is on death row for 50 years. And so when we talk about bringing closure to victims and family members who've lost loved ones, this is not the answer. And so again, another huge con is, I think the likelihood of this bill, either bill, the Senate and the House bill now look different regarding the death penalty, but I think the likelihood of either bill being found unconstitutional is great, and we will find ourselves having to retry these cases in probably about a decade, and we will cause victims, loved ones to be re-traumatized by this process, and we will cost the state of Florida hundreds of billions of dollars.
Listen, thanks very much, Allison, for today. I really appreciate all the information, and I think it was very clearly presented. And I'm hoping that what you are saying will turn out to be the case, even though it may take a while for that to happen in the Supreme Court. But let's hope it it does happen that way.
And you, the last thing you asked, I don't mean to interrupt, I apologize, was what can you do?
Right.
Please reach out to your legislators, especially if you have Republican legislators, to say, listen, you know, I think because I have to be honest, I've met with a lot of legislators, and this I don't think is anybody, well, there's probably some legislators, this is their biggest priority. For a lot of people, there's a lot going on in legislative session, as we know, right? And so the death penalty is not at the top of the priority list for a lot of people. And a lot of legislators I've met with, frankly, don't understand how the system works now, don't understand how the bill would apply. And so if we reach out to people to say, hey, look, you know, my understanding is that the odds of this being struck down by the United States Supreme Court, even this Supreme Court, are pretty high. Then we're going to have to do all this again, and all the cost and the heartache. And so my hope is with more awareness, because we're seeing that in the Florida Senate. So with more awareness, the Senate sponsor of the bill, Blazin Golia, has filed two amendments already. And so with awareness comes power. And that I'm hoping, and that's, you know, it's just a lot of this is based on misinformation. The governor has said that the Cruz verdict was a lone holdout juror basically hijacking the jury. And that's not true. The foreman of that jury, his name is Benjamin Thomas, did an interview with the media almost immediately after the verdict and said that there were three definitive votes for life in that case. And so that's where, with information comes great power. I'd encourage you to reach out to your legislators to say this is a priority. We should be focusing on, you know, fixing property insurance and affordable housing for working class Floridians, and not making it easier to kill people who may not even be guilty. Yeah.
Thanks very much, Allison. Don't know when we'll be talking to you again, but probably something will happen down the line, I suspect.
Thanks, Cal.
Thank you very much. Bye-bye. Bye-bye. Over here, Calvin, and shut it off.